be done in time for have some break between the session and Vespers. My name is Dan Spencer. I'm on the summer program coordinating staff here. And the title of this session has got sort of various titles. Gay and Christian, what are the issues? What are the questions? I sometimes put a little subtitle up of at least some things you've always wanted to know about being gay but didn't know who, what, or how to ask. This Ms. Mitt is an informative, an hour where we can get our questions out and share our own experiences and try to learn together about what are the issues at stake with people who are gay and Christian, the issue of homosexuality in the church, those kinds of things. I think I'll start with probably talking for 15-20 minutes or so, just to lay out some of my thoughts and talk a little bit about my own experience. But most of what I want the session to be is just a chance for all of us to raise questions and share experiences and perspectives together. No need for us to arrive at any consensus by the end of the hour, but it is a helpful time, I think, simply to talk. I find that oftentimes around this issue, one of the most common responses when I talk to people is, well, Dan, I've never met anybody who is gay. And that seems to be a lot of people's experience of never knowing anybody that they knew was gay or lesbian. And so about 80% of why I do these sessions is just simply to have people have a chance to talk to someone who is gay and have a chance to ask questions and say what's on their mind. What I'm going to do, I think, is start by reading a short story that will root the whole question of this in the area of experience, and then talk a little bit about my own experience and some questions that have come up for me before opening it up to a larger discussion. So I'm going to start with a little story called The Boy. It's about 5 minutes, I think, when I timed it. I want to tell a story. It's a story about a boy who grew up in a large family with lots of sisters and a brother in a big house where he learned to love and to be loved. The boy loved many things. He loved the nearby mountains with the boulders to climb on and the rushing streams. He loved little children. Even as a child, he loved children and dreamed of the day when he would have his own family with children. The boy was often sick and spent many hours and nights on a respirator and getting weekly shots. But he didn't mind too much, because it meant he could read, which he loved, and sometimes it meant more time in the mountains, where his legs and lungs grew strong. But one day it did make him sad, because his sickness meant he had to go away from his family to school in another state. So the boy went, and he learned to love new things, early morning walks on the prairie, thunderstorms in the fall and spring, snow in the winter, and of course children. He soon became the expert babysitter at the school and began to care for children in many of the faculty families. And he was happy for a while. But all was not well, for he was learning that while people talked about loving other people, they only meant some other people. It seemed it was all right for boys to have girlfriends, and girls to have boyfriends, and even girls had girlfriends. But boys were never to have boyfriends. It puzzled him that most of his friends were interested in only girls, and he was not. But it didn't bother him too much. He got a girlfriend, and he figured that he too would change like the other boys. Soon it was time to go to college, and the boy knew that he could now study what he had always loved, the mountains, the prairies, the rivers and boulders. So he went to a college where he could study the earth, to learn her history, unravel her mysteries. There he soon became friends with another boy who was also studying geology, and they began to do many things together, even spending summers working together in the mountains. They were both Christians. They taught Sunday school class together and spent many hours talking and talking. Gradually, the boy realized that he was in love with his friend, which frightened him badly. And he prayed and prayed that God would change him soon so that he too could have girlfriends like the other boys. He didn't know what he had done to be the way he was, but he knew that it must have been very bad. Then one day his friend came to him with exciting news. He was in love with a girl who was a friend to both of them. Now the boy was very confused and sad, and he went to the woods he loved so and cried. Once more he tried to talk to God, but it didn't seem that God was listening. He just couldn't understand. He knew that if one believed, one was saved. And grace was a gift given unconditionally without works. But he also knew that boys who loved boys were never saved, but evil. He knew that who he was so terrible he could never tell anyone. And he began to walk in front of cars on the highway by the woods, hoping that they would take him away from his pain. The boy went to the school counselor, who was also a friend from his church, but he was so ashamed he made up another story. That helped for a while, but he still loved his friend, who now spent all his time with his new girlfriend. They didn't teach Sunday school together anymore, or talk for hours on end. Finally, the boy decided he needed to leave, and so he went to Latin America, where he again lived close to the land he loved, with simple, warm people. And he was happy. The hurt was less now, and while he still prayed to be changed, he began to feel that maybe he was just meant to never have anyone to love. He didn't understand why, and he was sad that he would never have the family he had always wanted. And so the years passed, and sometimes it hurt very much, and sometimes not so much. His friend married the girl, and the boy was the best man. Then they moved away, and the boy went away to the mountains to live. Once more it was hurting too much, and so he decided that he must find a way to change, or he could not go on living with the pain. After 3 months, he got up enough courage to go visit the village pastor, someone he admired very much. He summoned up his courage, looked at the pastor and said, "What I want to know is, do you believe in healing for homosexuals?" There. He had said it. Someone knew. Even if he changed now, someone would always know. He had never felt so naked, so exposed, so vulnerable, or so honest. Yes, he found he felt vulnerable, but to his surprise, he felt a huge weight lifted from him. Finally, the ball was in the other court. If the pastor said no, or got angry, or whatever, he felt now that he could die in peace. At least the horrible truth was no longer bottled up, stewing inside him. And then he found that God's grace often comes in unsuspecting packages. The pastor looked at him without even batting an eye and calmly said, "That depends on whether there is a brokenness." Well, the boy was stunned. Could revelation, the gospel, the good news, really come through 8 simple words? Could 23 years of perspective be stood on end so simply, so calmly? They were. The boy finally received and experienced the grace he had heard about for so long. He understood the metanoia, the turnaround. Suddenly, those oft-repeated words became real to him, central to his being. "Nothing can separate me from the love of God." At that moment, nothing could. The years have passed. The boy has learned more about receiving grace, about being a receptacle of grace to others. The boy still loves other boys, and sometimes this hurts him, because there are still many that don't believe that God's grace is meant for boys who love boys. Sometimes the boy feels that way too. But when the boy feels like that, when he feels very sad and unable to talk even to those who love him best, he remembers the story, his story. And he remembers the stories of others, too, of how nothing separated them from the love of God. And sometimes he's sad, but hopeful, too. And he hopes that his story might help other people, like their stories have helped him. Well, the story is not just any story. It happens to be my own story. And I'll talk a little bit more about that during our time together. But I find that on this issue that's so painful for us to talk about sometimes and has people so deeply divided in the church, it's really important to begin by rooting it in the lives of real people. I think sometimes we too quickly jump to the debate itself and want to know what the latest clinician is saying or what the latest biblical interpretation is saying. We forget there are real people involved. Real people who have lives and have feelings and have family relationships. And so when I talk about the issue of homosexuality, I find it really important to start by rooting in the lives of real people, in this case in my own life. The story tells you some things about me. Obviously it's a looking back and an interpretation of my life. some of the facts and figures. I grew up in California in a large Catholic family, 6 kids. I was number 3 of the 6. And I think I had a pretty normal childhood. We're all very close in age, all 15 months apart, so it was a jumble of us. I first began to be aware of being different from the other kids when I started, probably about junior high. And I think that it picked up during the time of puberty and adolescence, when I first began to have a lot of sexual feelings awakening within my body, the same way all my friends were. Only all my friends who were boys were having these sexual feelings drawn towards girls, and I was having them to the other boys. And that was a very confusing experience for me. Nothing had prepared me for having that happen to my body. And I'd heard all the jokes on the playground about fags and homos and queers and dykes and all the terrible things. There was nothing worse than being called a fag or a homo. And so it was a very frightening period, as well as being confusing. I didn't know what to do. On top of all the social pressures and the peer pressures, I had all the religious stuff put on top. I'd heard Leviticus quoted before, that if any man lies with a man, it's an abomination, they shall be put to death. That was pretty scary as a 12-year-old to think about what that meant. I didn't have enough handles yet at that point to know what it meant for me, but all I knew was I was scared and I didn't have anybody to talk to. So I stayed in the closet. We use the term, gay and lesbian people talk about being in the closet when we hide from other people and hide from ourselves the true nature of our sexual orientation. And I stayed in the closet all through high school and all through college. Throughout high school, I pretty much assumed during all that time that I would change into a heterosexual at some point. I thought this was just a phase I was going through. And I remember surreptitiously going to the library to find books on homosexuality, going there when no one would see me and when the librarian wouldn't be around, and trying to sneak a book out and see. And they talked about, latent homosexuality was sometimes a phase people went through, and I just clung to that hope for years. This was just latent homosexuality. It was just a phase I was going through. I was really as normal as everybody else. The thing that part of what was really scary for me was all the stereotypes I heard about homosexuals were pretty horrible things. They were child molesters. They waited in dark alleys for people at night. They did horrible, horrible things. And it was really terrifying for me to think maybe that's what I was, even though nothing about who I was at that point had indicated to me that that's the kind of thing I was going to do for the rest of my life. But it was the kind of, when you're young, when I was young, it was sort of an either-or picture. If I were gay, it meant I was all these horrible things. And that was pretty scary. So I tried to fit in the game. I had girlfriends and dated and tried to do all those things that I knew I was supposed to be doing. And that also helped hide who I was by playing along those games. Unfortunately, on the way, I hurt some women friends of mine very badly who thought we were in more of a relationship than I was willing to or able to give. But what really changed for me was the whole experience of falling in love with my best friend in college. And one of the reasons why I talk in the story about, throughout the story, talks about the theme of love, the things in my life that have been important to me, that have given me shape to my values and my identity, have been the things I've loved. And that, for me, is at the heart of this issue. It really is an issue about who we are, who we love, and who with whom we're in relationship. The experience of falling in love with my best friend and convinced me that I was, in fact, gay, that I was not simply in a phase that I was passing through. And I had to find some way of coming to grips with that. My closest friends up to that point had been women friends, and in many ways continue to be. Well, I think one of the myths or stereotypes about gay men is that we hate women, and I'm sure there are some gay men who do, but the vast majority I know don't. My closest friends were women. But there was something qualitatively different about my relationship with my friend Dan than with my women friends, and that triggered something for me. I knew that meant that I was gay. I didn't have any way of reconciling that with being a Christian. And nothing in my experience of being a Christian, growing up Catholic and then participating in a Baptist church, being involved in InterVarsity Christian Fellowship in college, nothing gave me any tools about how to reconcile these two. And so I spent a period of about 6 years in daily prayer, praying that God would change me, to turn me into a heterosexual. And it wouldn't happen. It just didn't happen. And I talked to the school counselor, and I wrote away to Norman Vincent Peale, who just told me if I believed even more positively, I would change. It didn't happen. So eventually, I came to Holden Village. All roads lead to Holden Village, I suppose, at some point. Really, I had a lot of reasons why I came here, but one of them was I just decided I really need to reconcile this issue. I'd either have to find a way to reconcile this, and I was still assuming that meant becoming heterosexual, or it was just too painful to keep living. Fortunately, while I was at Holden, I met some really lovely, caring, compassionate people who gave me some alternative ways of understanding the gospel. For the first time, allowed the compassion of Jesus and the good news of the gospel to really sink in on me. I'd been working so hard to earn my salvation up to that point. And so from Holden, my journey has continued through a lot of different areas. I've been to seminary, I got a master's in divinity. And it's been a journey where I've met many other people who've struggled with issues similar to mine. And my other gay Christian friends, we found a lot of support in talking to each other about what we've learned out of this. Let me just say a few other things, and then I'll open it up. I don't want to talk too long. I want to say a couple things about the experience of being in the closet. It's one of the most destructive places to be for any human being, to have to take who you know yourself to be and lie about that, and project an image out to other people in order to not let people know who you are. It causes relationships to be built on dishonesty. It causes people to become estranged from each other without even knowing the reason why. In my own situation, I came from a family where we were very close to each other, and then I went through a period of 3 or 4 years where my family couldn't understand why I was growing more and more distant. And in retrospect, we knew it was because I was getting increasing pressure to get married. And they were treating that as something fun, and that was something delightful. For them it was. For me, it was terrifying. I remember when my oldest sister got married. She got married at 27. I was 23 at the time. And she and I had been the two who really hadn't done a lot of dating. And so the joke in our family was, well, Danny has 4 more years. Danny has 3 more years. Danny has 2 more years to get married. You know, the countdown to age 27. And they meant it as a sign of affection. For me, it was an absolutely terrifying experience having that happen. But the closet is the total experience of fear. Your life begins to be run by fear. And you take your worst fears and project them out, and then you build your life around those projected fears. And even people who are most supportive, you can't even be aware of that because of the kind of fear that happens. That's what I find so destructive about being forced to hide who we are. And for me, that's the total opposite of what the gospel is. Someone quoted to me that perfect fear casts out all love, which is a little twist on our familiar phrase of perfect love casts out all fear. But I know that's true. Perfect fear does cast out all love. And it's why it's so important that gay people not be shut off from the gospel. Our society is one that is thoroughly homophobic. The term homophobia is a term you may or may not be familiar with. It's a term that we use to describe both the fear of and the anger and hatred of gay and lesbian people in our society. And those of us who are gay and lesbian grow up with that as well. We experience it a little differently than other people who aren't gay. Instead of hating people out there, we hate ourselves. We internalize the hatred and the fear in our society, and that becomes self-hatred and self-fear. But all of us grow up with that, whether it's the childhood jokes on the playground or whatever. Being gay in the church, I think, is particularly painful sometimes. There's a whole added moral stigma to who one is. In my experience, nothing turns the gospel into law and judgment more quickly than the issue of homosexuality. And nothing, for me, one of the most painful things was it turned the Bible for me from the word of life to a book of terrorism. And I don't use that word lightly. It really became a book of terror. The Bible, which I had experienced as the source of the gospel, the book of life, the thing that gave me, brought me into relationship with Jesus, brought me into relationship with the whole history of the people of God, now was reduced to 6 Bible verses, 3 in the Old Testament, 3 in the New. And I started affectionately calling them the Bible bullets, because it's the kind of thing, no matter how much I give testimony to my own faith, people pull out these 6 verses and begin to shoot. Romans, 1 Corinthians, 1 Timothy, Leviticus, Genesis, you know, they're just the boom, boom, boom. And that somehow is supposed to negate everything else about my life as a Christian. So it's been a very sad thing for many of us who are gay or lesbian, who are Christian, to have the Bible stolen from us and turned against us as a weapon. But that's been our experience. As I've indicated, being gay can be a very painful thing. I think for most of us growing up, it is. There are very few gay people I know who grew up without having that be a painful part of their lives. Very few gay people I know who would ever repeat their adolescent years. That may be true for many of us. Adolescence is a painful time for all of us. But for gay and lesbian people, it's particularly painful. And yet, I would also say that being gay can be an extremely wonderful thing. And I've experienced it to be a real gift in my life. I think being gay and Christian can be a particularly wonderful thing. It has in my own life and the life of many of my friends and community, help lead us to a deeper spirituality, to understand what our faith in God really is based on, a faith that's based on trust, a faith of believing God's word and not the word of the world around us. It has been a way for me to understand at a gut level other people's pain and suffering. It's helped connect me to other people who are oppressed, whether those are people of color in our society, whether women, people outside our society who suffer from poverty. My experience of oppression is different than theirs, but knowing what that feels like helps me to understand at some level what it's like for all people who are oppressed, and I experience that as a real gift in my faith. I think gay and lesbian people are helping us to understand different and sometimes healthier ways to be male and female. That, may, for example, relationships between men don't have to be built on competition. That men can be friends with each other, can experience intimacy, can be vulnerable to each other without having their manhood questioned. And so I think there's some real gifts in the experience of being gay that the wider society and church can benefit from. And it's been interesting to watch what's happened in my own life, life with my family. My family, ironically, I think, is far closer now because of me coming out to them than we were before. We always were a close family, but we also were one of the families that learned very early on that there were a lot of things you didn't talk about, particularly anything that had to do with sexuality. And yet, as I talk with my brothers and sisters now, those are oftentimes the areas we had the most questions and confusion about, and we didn't know how to talk to them. In my family, my dealing with me being gay and asking my family to deal with that with me has opened us all up to being much freer and honest to each other about who we are. And in fact, about 4 years ago, my mother, one of the most wonderful moments I've had with my mother, we sit down and she's talking and she said, "You know, this was so hard for me when you came out and I didn't even know if I'd be able to recover. But I am so grateful that you are gay now, and I'm so grateful that you talked about it to me, because it has opened up the world to me in ways that never would have happened. And I've had to question the way I understood the world, and I just think I'm a far better person, and our family is a far better family for that." So we've experienced it as a real gift in our own family as well. Not without moments of deep pain, and not without moments of confusion where we had to really struggle with issues. But because we were committed to each other, we worked through a lot of that, and has brought real healing in our lives. So I'll stop at that point, because I want to hear what other people's questions and experiences are. And just open this up from my perspective, any question is fair game. If I don't feel comfortable answering it, I'll happily say that, but I'd rather have you ask the question than censor it before you even have a chance to ask it. So, Chuck.
I have to leave a couple minutes before, but I have two things. One, and the bullets give a brief response to those.
Okay.
How do you deal with those as an
idiot? There are two ways I deal with it. One is the actual exegesis of those six passages. I think you can take a look at every single one of them and question some of the traditional ways that are like the story of Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis 19. I don't want to do that now just because it would take too long, but that's a legitimate question. I've got several resources here that talk to the New Testament of homosexuality as a homosexual neighbor that do precisely those good exegeses. There are also some good tapes here. John Schramm did an excellent session on it. That's one way to look at it. For example, the Sodom and Gomorrah story, most biblical scholars now looking at it think it deals with the violation of hospitality codes. And what was particularly bad about that was that the hospitality that was violated were divine messengers, the angels. So they don't think it has anything really to do with homosexuality itself. If there's homosexuality in the passage itself, it's in the context of violent rape and lust, which is a very different thing than the issue of homosexuality per se. I'd be the first to condemn homosexual acts that are committed as rape or lust, but that's different than the topic itself. The other question has to do with how we understand Scripture itself, and this is where I, you know, growing up Catholic, I gained a different perspective, but I really have benefited from all my exposure to Lutherans. I think some of the Lutheran understanding of Scripture, and particularly like Luther's wonderful image of the Bible being the manger that holds the Word of God and holds Christ, and that as being a very powerful one. It has forced me to get away from a literalistic understanding of Scripture. For example, the way that Scripture for centuries was used literalistically to justify slavery, because it's through and through the Bible. We now most of us who are Christians no longer would use scripture to try and justify slavery, even though we can find proof text to do that. I think this homosexuality is fairly similar. One of the difficulties is the whole understanding of homosexuality as a sexual orientation as part of a person is only about 100 years old. Up until that time, it really was assumed that all people were heterosexual, and some people chose to deviate from that. That was why it was called perversion. They perverted their sexuality willfully and moved away from that. Now, both from the experience of gay and lesbian people talking about their own experience and from more of the social science perspective, we have a far better understanding that roughly 10% of the population is predominantly gay or lesbian in their sexual orientation. And that's very different than the biblical writers could have had any possibility of understanding. And so it means our context is somewhat different today than when those particular six passages were written. There's lots of other things we could talk about, but...
Let me just add one more
thing. Yeah.
I come from a similar family to yours, except we're Lutheran. Mm-hmm. Eight of us, eight children in the family. I have a gay brother who is nearly my age, he's in, about 40, who has not come out of the closet.
Mm-hmm.
Is a very withdrawn, and I'm sure it has to do with his entire experience growing up, you know. What would your suggestion be for me as a brother concerned about his happiness? I see him as a sad type person. He's a very loving person.
Mm-hmm.
He's always been the one that's cared for all the people in our family. We have a big extended family, also all the people in our family who were ever ill and dying, and he was the one that always went to live with them and stayed with them and all that. What do you do?
Well, let me ask just a question. What you say he's not out of the closet, yet you know he's gay. Has he come out to you?
He came out to my brother, my other brother, very gently. I mean, it is obvious from his relationships and from the types of things that he is doing that he is gay.
Is he aware that you know he's gay? And that's where it gets a little tricky sometimes.
Yeah, I'm not sure he is.
Okay, because if he's aware that you know he's gay, then I would talk to him.
Yeah.
I think there's nothing better. One of the most horrible things about this issue is the kind of silence that pervades it. And people won't talk about it for a variety of reasons. And that makes those of us who are gay or lesbian feel extremely isolated. If he's aware that you know, just talk to him about it and just be real honest about where you're coming from. If there are things you don't understand, say that. But the most important thing is that you just affirm him, that your love and concern for him.
Yeah.
If he's not aware and you're not comfortable in talking to him, and I'd say this for other people as well, one of the most important things that you can do is in your conversation in general, make it clear to people where you stand on the issue. And that doesn't mean you have to come out and be out there marching for civil rights and stuff for gay people. It can mean that when you hear an anti-gay comment or joke, that you challenge it and you say, I don't think that's funny. There are people I know in my life who are gay or lesbian, and those kinds of things hurt them and they hurt me, and I don't want you to hear say that. We do that now with terms like nigger, which were not, which people threw around 20 years ago much more commonly. Now we don't do it anymore. We challenge it. Challenge anti-gay language stuff. Or, if depending on where you are, your own personal comfort with it, bring it up in other contexts. There are plenty of contexts in our society to bring it up where you can just, in a gentle way, say that you can maybe even say, while I don't fully understand the issue supportive, I think it's really important that gay and lesbian people have full civil rights in our society. I don't think anybody should lose their job for being gay or lesbian, or I don't think anybody should lose their housing. So those are ways, not only for your brother, but every other closeted gay person around you or person who knows someone's closeted will hear that and will feel comfortable talking to you. The thing that's really critical for gay and lesbian people who are closeted, we become very good listeners, and we listen to conversations, and we learn very quickly who we can trust and who we can't based on the kinds of conversations. And so, whereas you may think laughing at a gay joke is a really harmless activity, if I'm in the room and see you laughing at it, I'll cross you off the list as someone I can ever trust. And so it's very critical that we pay attention to those kinds of things. But in the case of your brother, if you could feel comfortable talking to him, just talk with him and express your compassion and concern and support for him. The other thing I want to just mention, since you brought the experience of your brother, I think it's a really powerful and beautiful experience, the role that he's played in the family. And I Nothing makes me more angry than the stereotype and the myth that gay people are anti-family or that we're dangerous to the family. You talked about how your brother oftentimes plays the role of being the nurturer and the caretaker of other family members who are ill. That's been my experience time and again. It's very hurtful for me to have people project onto me an image that I'm anti-family for some reason. I remember talking to someone who simply said, blessed is the family that has a gay or lesbian son or daughter, because those are oftentimes the ones who have the time, the energy, the space to deal with parents when they get elderly, with other siblings. In my situation, I have four nieces and nephews with whom I'm very close. And my other sisters and brothers who are married and have their own families don't have the ability or the time and the energy to be an uncle or an aunt in the way that I can to them. I spend a lot of time with them. I have five godchildren who are extremely important to me. It's real important for me that the children in my family, extended family, have some alternative male or adult role models. And that's one area that I think many, many gay lesbian people I know are extremely devoted to their families. Others are very alienated, and for other reasons, but I think that we need to work towards the healing of that alienation rather than simply perpetuating it. I don't know if that's helpful to your specific area or not, but yeah. Another thank you. And if you're up in the balcony, yell down. I may not see you. Ralph.
Yeah, Dan. In conversations that I've had elsewhere and here the last few weeks, it seems that so often when we discuss the concern of the gay, lesbian role in society, in relationships with people, the issue immediately becomes an ethical one. And you've presented it, and it's been presented here, that it's really not necessarily a matter of ethics. It's more a matter of just our human condition, that we're just created in various ways. And that from my experience, seems to be an essential distinction that we make in the discussion, that our sexuality is just part of who we are. And it's not an ethical thing, it's just a creation concern.
I would agree with you, Ralph. I think that there are many ethical issues that stem from the question once we talk about them. I would argue that oftentimes they're the opposite of the way we phrase the question. Oftentimes the question is phrased, for example, should gay and lesbian people be allowed in the church and still be gay and lesbian? Well, for one thing, gay and lesbian people have always been in the church and we're still in the church. The fact that the problem is most of us have to lie about it to stay in the church. We have to lie about who we are. I would turn that question around and say the ethical question is not whether we should be allowed in the church. The ethical question is on what basis does the church continue to cause persecution and suffering of gay and lesbian people by forcing us to be dishonest, forcing us to be closeted. That, for me, is a very important ethical question, because I think the church is acting against the demands of the gospel by singling out and persecuting a minority of people on some fairly shaky ground sometimes. So there are a lot of ethical implications that come up. But we had an interesting experience here a couple weeks ago. I participated in a church in Minneapolis called Spirit of the Lakes Community Church, which is predominantly gay and lesbian. About 90% of the congregational body is gay or lesbian. There were seven members of that church who were here at Holden for a week, the last week of June. We had a panel discussion one evening called Gay and Christian, Why Do We Stay in the Church? The five of us simply shared some of our spiritual journeys and talked about why we in fact stay in the church. But there are about 700 people attending that church right now. We have two services each Sunday, and they draw between 300 and 350 to each service. Well over half of those people have left the church, and this is their attempt to come back. And you talk to everybody in that church, and they just simply say, the church was the most damaging and the most painful part of my life, and I had to leave it in order to find some sense of wholeness in my life. That raises serious ethical questions. If the church is meant to be the faithful people of God, that's introducing people to the gospel of life, and yet it's having that kind of impact on gay and lesbian people. Serious questions there, but you're right. For me, at least, the ethical questions are not about our sexuality per se. It's the behaviors that come out of that. It's the ways we choose to deal with that. It's a question here, and then Chris. Yeah.
I don't remember his name, but there's a man at Yale who's done some research on same-sex marriages.
Right.
He found the Vatican. I'll have you comment on
the man's name is John Boswell, and about 10 years ago, he came out with a groundbreaking work called Christianity, Social Tolerance, and Homosexuality. And I'll get to your question just a minute by way of this question. What Boswell did was research the Christian teaching on sexuality from the earliest first few centuries up and through about 1100 or so, because one of the things that oftentimes come up when we bring up this issue as gay and lesbian Christians is say, well, the church has always taught this way. Why should we change after 2,000 years of church teaching? Well, what Boswell did was do a lot of very, very critical research and just digging through everything and found out that the church has not always taught the same thing. That in fact, he has several different examples of when the church's teaching was accepting of same-sex relationships. There were openly gay bishops at certain periods of times in the church. His most recent work is he's also in the process of just discovered liturgies for same-sex marriages that took place in roughly, I think the time period is from about 1,000 to 1,200 years after, you know, AD. And so his book that's due out in this fall is simply going to be the documentation of this, that there has not always been a unified Christian teaching on homosexuality. And in fact, the Christian church has unfortunately taken its cues much more from the outside culture rather than from the gospel on that. And he details very carefully how that has developed. But he will be supposed to be coming out with a book now that shows many of these liturgies that were same-sex marriage liturgies from earlier in the church period. Chris.
I think it would be helpful if you could define some terms for it.
Sure, please. Yeah, and that's a good blanket statement. If anything I'm saying is not clear or confusing, please ask me.
The history of the word lesbian, the history of the word dyke, faggot, mm-hmm. Anything else that
sure.
I may have known. Because I think if when I found out what they meant, I just, you know, I couldn't believe that people would actually use something like that.
Okay. So. Yeah, and that's a good question, too. People oftentimes wonder why we prefer the terms gay and lesbian over homosexual as well. Interestingly, the term homosexualism is a younger term, more recent term than either gay or lesbian. Those both predate the term homosexual. Lesbian simply comes from the island of Lesbos, and many of you may be familiar a little bit with the history of Sappho, the queen of Lesbos, and it was a women's community, a women's warrior community, and the term lesbian makes reference to that. It's the term that homosexual women choose to name themselves with as lesbians. The term gay I've read a variety of different roots from it. The earliest reference, Boswell cites the earliest reference in here to about 400 years ago in the courts of France and England. The term being used as a pits falling from the sky as a term that either meant effeminate or men being with men. In this society, it comes most from the fact that in the turn of the century, in the first few decades in the society, homosexual people began to create a subculture for themselves in the cities, and primarily in New York City, in Greenwich Village first, and it was termed the gay life. They went to the city to live the gay life, or the bohemian subculture in Greenwich Village, so forth, as opposed to the straight life that everybody else lived everywhere else. And gradually, the terms gay and straight got applied more to homosexual and heterosexual, but that's where the term gets used a lot. Terms like faggot, faggot is a term that has a very painful history for those of us who are gay or lesbian. It comes, to the best of our knowledge, from the witch burning trials in Europe during the late medieval period, and when particularly women who were accused of being witches were burned at the stake, oftentimes homosexual men were rounded up and used as the faggots to start the bonfire. Faggot, if you look up the dictionary in Webster's definition, Webster's dictionary, simply means a bundle of sticks used to light a fire. Well, homosexual men were rounded up and used to light these bonfires that burned witches, and therefore simply got called faggots. And when you wanted to start a bonfire, you found someone who was accused of being homosexual. Many of the other terms, the term dyke comes from, go ahead.
Does that mean that these men made the fire, or they made the fire?
They were burned. Their bodies were used
to
start the fire. Yeah,
yeah,
I'm sorry.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, they were used. They were burned at the stake to start the fire to burn the witches.
Okay.
So in that sense, it was a very painful history for us. When people call us fags, it evokes a history that's very painful. I'm wearing a button tonight that has a pink triangle on it. A pink triangle is one of the symbols of gay liberation. Comes from our experience during World War II, during the Holocaust. I think most of us are probably pretty familiar with the history of the Jewish people during the Holocaust, at least the broad picture that 6 million Jews were put to death under Hitler's regime in the concentration camps. Fewer of us are probably aware that the second largest group of people put to death in the concentration camps were homosexuals. The Jewish people were forced to wear a yellow Star of David that signaled their crime of being Jewish. Homosexual men were forced to wear a pink triangle for our crime of being homosexuals. And the numbers vary in terms of how many tens of thousands were actually put to death, because the records vary. But tens of thousands of homosexual people were burned in the ovens during the Holocaust. And so this became a symbol for us as of never again. One of the really horrible pieces of the World War II history is that when the concentration camps were liberated by the armies from the United States, France, England, and the Soviet Union, the homosexual prisoners were put back in the concentration camps. Everyone else was let out. But since being homosexual was a crime in all four of the countries of the liberating armies, we were returned to the concentration camps. And there's a very chilling sequence of film footage that shows this in a movie called Pink Triangles, where someone, for some reason, thought to film this and showed the men with the pink triangles being rounded up by the liberating armies and being put back in the concentration camps, re-imprisoned. So that's where the pink triangle comes from, as part of some of our heritage. I wanted to mention one thing just about the colors. The pink and lavender are some of the colors that are associated with the pink for some other reasons and lavender for a variety of reasons. But I was talking about one of the things that what the gay and lesbian people, we often do when we're in the closet, is live out of our projected fears. We have many fears, and it's hard, and it's a frightening world to live in, and so oftentimes we live based on those fears rather than an accurate perception of reality. It's an understandable response. All oppressed people do it as a matter of survival. But what we had up here at Holden a few weeks back, we had a day called Gay and Lesbian Awareness Day when all these people from the Spirit of the Lakes were here, where we set a day aside to really talk about some of these issues. And the day before that, I was making the announcement at dinner, and I simply suggested to people, I said, if you want to find some way to enter into the day, one thing you can do is wear the traditional colors of the gay and lesbian people. Put some pink or lavender on during the day. And that's just one way to enter into the day. Well, it was an amazing experience when the next day, roughly half of the village was dressed with pink and lavender on. I mean, Gertrude Lemton was wonderful. I don't know if Gertrude's here, but Gertrude was dressed head to toe in pink and purple. And one thing, it gave kind of a festive atmosphere to the day, but the other thing that was incredibly important, there are several closeted gay and lesbian staff members here at Holden. We have a support group, and we meet and talk about what it's like to be a gay or lesbian, talk about our issues at Holden, talk about the issue in the rest of our lives. But the other members of that support group commented afterwards that that act, probably more than anything else that day, was so wonderful, because for the first time we got to break past some of our projected fears about what would so-and-so think if she knew I were gay? What would he think if he knew I were gay? We could see a lot of these people wearing pink or lavender, and we knew that in some sense they were at least open to discussing the issue. And many of us choose that opportunity to talk to other people then in the community. And I remember talking with many of the non-gay members of the Holden community who felt so pleased and happy to have a way to express some kind of support in a way that they said, I'm also open to talking about that. So that was a way for us to break through our projected fears, to start dealing with people, to realize that there were many people in Holden who were open and affirming of us and willing to talk about it. I don't know if that answers some of your questions. You just see if there's anything up.
I just was wondering what you feel about gay couples, lesbian couples adopting, conceiving, raising children.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the most wonderful things for me about my church experience is that there are many, many couples there who have children. Most of them have children from previous marriages. They were involved in heterosexual marriage, and then they still have their children from that, because I love kids, and so it's really wonderful in our church to have that. I realize it's a very difficult topic for many people, and I think that here is where some of the science can be, the sociological research, there are many issues involved, and some of the social science research can be very helpful. The studies have shown that children of households with two gay parents end up statistically with about the same sexual orientation range as children from heterosexual households. That is, roughly 10% of the children coming from a household headed by gay parents turn out to be gay. 90% of those children turn out to be heterosexual or bisexual, somewhere in there. And that's roughly the same statistic as happens in heterosexual households. What that's important is it means that probably parents have a lot less influence than they think about determining a child's sexual orientation. The other thing about research is it shows a child's sexual orientation is probably pretty well fixed by the time the child is 3 or 4. Certainly by the time the child enters school, the child's sexual orientation is pretty well determined by that time. He or she will not grow into expressing that for many, many more years, but the basic orientation is pretty well developed by that point. Some of the other issues that are involved are the importance of having both male and female role models in a household, and I think for many of my friends who are either lesbian couples or gay male couples who have children, make very strong efforts to make sure that their children have role models from the other gender in their lives, so the children grow up with positive role models of both genders. I, from my own perspective, if I think it depends a lot more on whether the relationship in the household is healthy rather than what the breakdown is of the gender of the couples involved. I think we have, you know, an awful lot of unhealthy households in our society, both heterosexual and homosexual. And so I think what's really critical is providing a societal system of support where we really begin to build healthier households. For those reasons, I really do support gay and lesbian couples having children if that's their choice, either from prior relationships or through adoption. For lesbian couples, many lesbian couples choose artificial insemination and birth their own children. But I realize it's a very controversial issue, and there are some, you know, valid concerns on both sides. Do you have a particular perspective yourself on that, or I don't know, or an experience out of which you've had contact with that?
I have many gay friends. I don't have any that have chosen to have children. My tendency would be that I don't have any problems with gay relationships, but I feel, as a parent myself, feel uncomfortable thinking about a child and being raised in that situation. But, you know, that might be based on my own ignorance.
Well, I think it's a very common feeling, and I certainly wouldn't denigrate or anything. I think one of the things that's very hard about anything to do with sexuality is that the less familiar we are with it, I think the more uncomfortable it is. And one of the ways I illustrate this, and I was talking with some of the high school kids here a few days ago, but if you think back to the very first time you became aware that your parents had had sex with each other. And I don't know if you can even remember that experience, but I know when my sisters and brothers and I were talking about it, it was just like, oh, gross! You mean they really did that? I mean, it was like our parents were one set of people, and sex was something else that happened. We just couldn't even conceive of the fact that they would actually do that to each other. I remember talking to my, and I don't mean this to be flip, I mean to talk about how hard it is for us to rethink our issues about sexuality, because they're very hard. My one of my cousins, who's the youngest of four kids in her family, her older sister was explaining sex to her, and talking about how she in fact had been born. And Maureen's response was, "You mean to tell me Mom and Dad did that four times?" But that's, I think, oftentimes what's at root in our what's really difficult about talking about sexuality is when we're unfamiliar with something, it initially can seem very repulsive and very, very different. And you think, if you think back to your own experience of growing through that and becoming aware of your own sexual feelings, working through the discomfort of building an intimate relationship with another person, all the discomfort early on in that relationship, I mean, all those things are involved. And so then, when you bring in something as explosive as homosexuality and introduce something even more explosive of children being involved in that, it's natural. It will bring up a lot of feelings of discomfort. But I think many other cases, when you actually begin to meet people who are involved in that, what turned me around on that, I had questions about that too, what turned me around on that was meeting really loving gay and lesbian couples with kids and seeing what a wonderful family life they had. Now, I also know some gay and lesbian couples who are real jerks, and the last thing I'd ever want was them to have access to children. But I don't think that has to do with sexuality as much as they're the way they are as people. Yeah.
I had a question because I have no idea what any statistics have done is to the length of relationship that a gay or lesbian would have with each other. Do they have, you know, like, I've been married 33 years, and is this common? Is there anybody studying?
Certainly it's less common, I would say, although not unheard of. I know a gay male couple that celebrated their golden anniversary 50 years a couple years ago, which to me is a miracle. How in the world they live 50 years together in this society.
You think that's true of heterosexuals as well, don't you?
Well, I think there's enormous stress on relationships, period, in our society. And I think the fact that so many relationships end in divorce, heterosexual relationships, only shows how much pressure there is on heterosexual relationships.
Right.
I would say that the pressure on homosexual relationships is a magnitude greater. If you think about all the ways of public affirmation and positive affirmation there are of heterosexual relationships that are absent for homosexual relationships, we have no way of getting married, so there's no way of publicly affirming our relationships. If we have children, there's no rites of baptism, things like that. We don't even have a way to publicly recognize our divorces, our breaking of relationships. We don't have ways to and recognize our anniversaries. If we choose to have a relationship and be in the church, we have to hide it. If we're hiding it from our family, we both go to separate places during Christmas time or holidays. I mean, there are so many stresses on homosexual relationships that are not there for heterosexual relationships that inevitably it puts a greater strain on them. Now, having said that, in my church, roughly half of the people there are in what they would describe as committed lifelong relationships. Half of the people in the church are not. Of those people involved in lifelong relationships, in the 2 years I've been in the church, I can name 3 or 4 of them that broke up, that they had considered to be lifelong relationships and have, for whatever reason, chosen to end. One of the things that was wonderful when we had the panel of the 5 of us here were my friends Lori and Jane, who have just celebrated their 8th anniversary. They've been together for 8 years. And they talked about how incredibly important it was finally to have a church experience where they could affirm their love for each other in a faith commitment. They'd never been able to do that before. They'd never found a church that would affirm them as a couple and offer them the kind of spiritual support that couples, I think, need. But in answer to your question, I don't know the statistics. I'm sure that there are fewer long-lasting homosexual relations than heterosexual, and I would say predominantly because, well, for one thing, it's much harder for us to meet each other in healthy environments. We can't. People often say to me, why do people go to gay bars to meet each other? And I say, have you ever tried to meet another gay person at a church social? You don't go to the church potluck to meet another gay or lesbian person in most churches I know. And so we have to create alternative communities to do that. Now, fortunately, there are a lot more healthy ways to do that now, like gay and lesbian churches, where we can meet each other that way. But we haven't had the societal support that to nurture our relationships, and so that's put extra pressure on. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just see if there's anybody else who hasn't asked a question, and we'll come back. Yeah.
The average length of a gay relationship is about 10 years. They're saying that's the kind of statistic.
Okay. And I don't know what kind of research that's based on, but that's probably accurate in some of the.
Yeah. Another point. Insurance. Because if you work and your spouse doesn't, it's like a lot of people want to have a spouse on their insurance. But in terms of policy, we'll only recognize.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole other area. The whole area of legal rights for gay and lesbian people is a big and important area. It really became came to the fore with the whole crisis around AIDS because we're not allowed to legally marry. We have no legal rights with our own spouses if we have a spouse. Ironically, the only way to do it before was for each spouse to adopt the other spouse as his or her child. That was, it's really bizarre to think about, it's the only way for us to get legal rights. And it becomes critical because there are many, many, many cases when one spouse, for example, came down with cancer and was in the hospital, and the hospital had a standard room, family only, for visits. And the spouse was not family and was therefore was not allowed into the hospital to visit his or her spouse. Or when the person dies, the house was in one of their name, not the other. They lose everything. As you say, the whole thing about insurance, it's virtually impossible for gay and lesbian people to get insurance as a family unit. So many, many of those questions come up and make it very difficult. There are only 2 states in the whole country that have, on a statewide basis, equal protection for gay and lesbian people in areas of housing, job discrimination, those kinds of things. That's Massachusetts and Wisconsin, and the current governor of Wisconsin is trying to repeal it. So, I live in the Twin Cities when I'm not in school in New York. Minneapolis has protection for gay and lesbian people. St. Paul does not. So those are really important issues for us. They had an incident, and unfortunately the trend has been against us in recent years. There are many, many Americans, I think, who feel that what happens in private between 2 consenting adults really is not the business of the state, but is the business of the consenting adults. But the Supreme Court did not agree with that in terms of homosexuality. 4 years ago, there was a case in Georgia where a police officer was trying to serve a warrant for a traffic violation on a man. He got a warrant for going into the man's house. When he came into the house, the man and his partner were having sex in the bedroom. And so the man arrested him not on the traffic, the police officer arrested him not on the traffic violation, but on committing sodomy, committing a homosexual act, and arrested him on that. The gay man sued him as that being a violation of his right to privacy. He eventually went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court voted in favor of the police officer, voted in favor of the state of Georgia, that they did not have a right to private consensual acts. And so in about 35 of our states, you can be legally convicted for having sexual activity between 2 people of the same gender. So the area of legal rights is a very critical one for us.
Are you basically in favor of the gay rights that's going on as you experience it?
Basically, I am, yeah.
The reason I ask that is because those of us who are older and have been in the church a long time have a lot of struggle with accepting all this. And in my experience, coming out of the church and the convention that I attended a year ago in Oakland, where the gay lesbian choir sang, and I mean, that's the way they were introduced, that's the way it was in the bulletin. And I have a hard time because I feel like it's flaunting, or it's, we don't have a homosexual, or a heterosexual choir. We don't announce it that way. And so I have a hard time accepting the flaunting of this,
yeah,
in the sense that even the liturgy for opening up the convention, the gay and lesbians had charge of it, and they held hands as they marched up, and they were up there by the altar. They had held hands during the whole liturgy, which, you know, a husband and wife, pastor, spouse, or two pastors married each other, they don't really flaunt it. And I felt like it was going too far, and it turned everybody off. In fact, it has made history, if you've ever read about it.
Well, that's a really good question, and I think it raises a lot of critical issues. It has, again, the issues of our own comfort levels and different things. It also raises questions of different perspective. As a homosexual person, I would say our society flaunts heterosexuality everywhere. I mean, I can't watch television without watching heterosexual people kiss, be in bed together. I can't watch a billboard on the driving down the freeway without watching a cigarette ad that shows if you smoke 10 cigarettes, you get the beautiful girl in the end. I mean, virtually every aspect of my life, heterosexuality is always being flaunted at me. Now, people accept that as normal because heterosexuality is, in our society, is defined as the only normal way to be. And so heterosexual people don't tend to experience that as flaunting heterosexuality. If that's not your experience, however, as it's not mine, it comes across as extremely flaunting. But that's from a perspective point. The other point, though, is even a more important question, I think, it's a difficult one. That has to do with the question of invisibility. Gay and lesbian people, unlike other sources of oppression, like African-American people, suffer oppression based on their skin color, and so they're a visible target. Gay and lesbian people, for the most part, we are non-distinguishable from our heterosexual sisters and brothers, other members of the community. And so unless we make ourselves visible, people assume we're not there. One of the absolute delightful things for me, when 2 weeks ago here at Holden, when we had the Gay and Lesbian Week, it was my very first experience that I can remember being at Holden. I've been here many times. I've been here many times as an openly gay person. Was the first time that I can remember where there was another openly gay person in the village. Now, virtually every other time I've been here, I've known many other gay and lesbian people here, but they've all been closeted. We have a support group now with 7 or 8, sometimes 10, gay and lesbian staff members here. So there are gay and lesbian staff members here, but because, for a variety of legitimate reasons, they choose to stay in the closet, I'm the only person that people can publicly identify with, for the most part, here. Now, the five of us sat up here, we told our stories. For some people, that's offensive enough, that we're simply visible. And I agree, sometimes things like holding hands and stuff, it really puts people off. I think it's, again, a question of discomfort. For me, one of the most painful times of the year is April, because it's the time of the year when I walk through the parks and it is overrun by heterosexual couples holding hands and kissing, doing whatever heterosexual couples do. Many people I know would say, isn't that sweet, they're in love. Well, on the one hand, it really is, and I want to affirm that. I don't want to be mocking that at all. Why it's painful for me is because that's denied me in this society. If I were to simply hold hands with my lover or partner or boyfriend or whatever, I'd be beat up or killed. I mean, it happens all the time. And so it makes it difficult because of the issue of silence and invisibility around it. We oftentimes have to find ways to make ourselves visible that make other people uncomfortable initially. And I agree with you. Sometimes it backfires. Sometimes strategically it's not the best way to do it. But I think I, for example, really support having gay and lesbian choirs. It's so very difficult for us to have positive role models. Anyway, for me to go to a concert where I see a choir up there that I know are gay and lesbian people is a wonderfully affirming thing, because our society operates on the other assumption. If you see a choir there that's just a choir, people assume they're all heterosexual. And so,
what difference does it make? Well, I mean, their voice is there to be heard. I really don't care who they go to bed with.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's, you know, that's another question. I mean, being about our sexuality is much bigger than who we go to bed with. Whether or not I ever have sex with another man, I am gay and I'm homosexual. That informs my whole way of looking at the world and interacting with people. But I don't know. I you know, it's issues. If you talk with different groups of oppressed people, by and large, they will tell you it does make a difference. For people who haven't experienced that form of oppression, it oftentimes is annoying or irritating. I think the same thing happened in the 1960s when black people began to take pride in being black. And you saw black consciousness groups forming, you saw black choirs forming, you saw black theater groups forming. For black people, that was a very important step of being able to find pride and affirmation of who they are. I mentioned before that one of the ways homophobia operates in our society, for heterosexual people, it becomes a way of fearing and hating people who are different than themselves. For homosexual people like myself, homophobia becomes a way of hating ourselves. And so for us to have positive role models, like a gay and lesbian choir, is a very powerful and important thing for helping us to overcome the self-hatred that we've had. And I know many heterosexual people who would also say, I'm really thankful now that I have some positive images of gay people. I've grown up with the same image as you did, that gay people are child molesters, that gay people are this and that. For me to see gay people singing spirituals was a wonderful thing. This is one of the most wonderful things that happened to me 2 weeks ago when we had the Gay and Lesbian Awareness Day, was some families came up to me. And afterwards, and they said, we are so grateful you are here because it's really important for us to, us and our family to have our children grow up with a positive gay and lesbian role models. And one of the mothers said, she said, I've got these children. One of them very well could grow up to be a gay or lesbian. I'm so grateful that they'll grow up with some positive role models and not only the negative ones. So I realize it's a delicate issue. It sometimes turns people off. But I think from the perspective of us, those of us who are gay and lesbian, it's really critical that we have positive role models.
Maybe you said this, but do you know what the percentage is in the United States of gays?
It's estimated to be roughly 10%. That based on some of the initial Kinsey surveys in 19... 19-